From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Mavis Staples is best known as a gospel singer with her family's group, the Staples Singers. But she's also a solo performer, and she recently joined forces with Prince for her latest album. On this edition of Fresh Air, the sacred and profane music of Mavis Staples. Also today, writer Marita Golden tells us about her new novel, spanning more than half a century in the life of a black family in Washington, D.C. Rock historian Ed Ward examines rock's long fascination with death. And television critic David Bianculli previews Cross of Fire, the real-life story of the Klan's rise to political power in a Midwest town. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. A U.S. warplane accidentally dropped a 500-pound bomb on a Navy-guided missile cruiser in the Indian Ocean today. The bomb detonated on impact and set off a small fire that was quickly extinguished, according to Navy officials. Five people reported wounded in that bombing. Officials say the bomb left a 5-foot hole in the ship's deck but did no damage to the outer hull. The aircraft carrier USS Lexington is in its home port of Pensacola, Florida today. A training jet yesterday slammed into its deck, killing five people and injuring 17 others. An official says the T-2 Buckeye jet was trying to make a landing but was flying too low. The jet hit the control tower and cartwheeled on the ship's deck. Four people burned American flags on the steps of the U.S. Capitol today. The protesters were challenging a new law that bans desecration of the American flag. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The four demonstrators were immediately arrested after they set fire to the flags. One of the flag burners read from a prepared statement challenging the police to arrest all four of the demonstrators so that the new law, which went into effect on Friday, could be tested before the Supreme Court. One of the protesters was Gregory Johnson, the Texas man whose flag-burning case prompted the Supreme Court decision in June that flag-burning was a constitutionally protected form of free speech. The Supreme Court ruling in June prompted a public outcry and led to the passage of the flag desecration law. The new law provides for a maximum penalty of 1 year in jail and a $1,000 fine. It has yet to be tested before the Supreme Court. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
An Arab guerrilla blew up a fishing boat today in a suicide attack on an Israeli gunboat off the coast of Lebanon. The guerrilla was killed in the explosion. Three Israeli soldiers were wounded. It was apparently the first suicide boat attack by an Arab guerrilla against an Israeli target. Reports that Israel is helping South Africa develop ballistic missiles prompted strong expressions of concern today from two administration officials. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Testifying before two House Foreign Affairs subcommittees today, Henry Sokolsky, deputy for nonproliferation policy at the Pentagon, said reports of Israeli-South African missile collaboration are a matter of serious concern at the highest levels of the Department of Defense.
DOD believes such collaboration is in no one's security interest.
Later at the same hearing, Assistant Secretary of State Richard Clark told reporters that the U.S. had received reports of Israeli-South African missile collaboration as early as January and started a dialogue with the Israelis as a result. He said that dialogue is ongoing. Clark and Sokolsky were on the Hill arguing against proposed legislation to punish other countries or their companies for spreading missile technology. The Bush administration maintains that current efforts to stop missile proliferation are succeeding and that the legislation would be counterproductive. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President Bush announced today he's sending a cabinet-level mission to Poland to help examine its economic needs. This is NPR. Hundreds of thousands of East Germans took to the streets again today to demand reforms. Deidre Berger has more from Cologne.
For the fourth week in a row, the Leipzig city center was filled tonight with demonstrators. East German authorities estimated that several hundred thousand people joined the demonstration. The protesters demanded recognition of the opposition and free elections. For the first time, the Leipzig mayor addressed the crowd. In the smaller town of Schwerin, an estimated 80,000 demonstrators marched tonight. Meanwhile, in Dresden, city authorities said they would recognize a small local opposition group. It is the first time any opposition group has been recognized in East Germany. And in East Berlin, leaders of the state-run union postponed a decision to oust the union's head, Politburo member Harry Tisch. In East Berlin, workers founded an independent union last week, and there have been reports of numerous resignations around the country from the party-led union. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
China says it's removing all martial law troops from Tiananmen Square for the first time since last June's bloody crackdown on pro-democracy activists. A Beijing city official says the removal of troops is a step toward easing martial law regulations. Former President Nixon is in China. Today he advised leaders there to improve relations with the U.S. Nixon warned China it risks economic stagnation and political turmoil if it returns to the isolation of the past. The Supreme Court today agreed to hear a case that could affect the retirement security of millions of workers. The court will hear arguments that will decide the scope of federal liability for pension plans of the LTV Corporation. LTV and many other corporations have their plans covered by the government's Pensions Benefit Guarantee Corporation. In other court action, lawmakers for the state of Missouri argued against federal court orders for financing a Kansas City school desegregation plan. The lawyers claim a judge went too far when he ordered Kansas City residents to pay higher property taxes to finance that plan. This is NPR News. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since she was a teenager, Mavis Staples has performed with her family in the Staples Singers. The quartet was led by her father, Pop Staples, and over the years included her brother and two of her sisters. By the late 50s, the Staples Singers were one of the most popular gospel groups in the country, and in the early 70s, they crossed over to the top of the pop charts with message songs like Respect Yourself and I'll Take You There. One of Mavis Staples' many fans is Prince, the rock, funk, singer-songwriter and producer. In 1987, he asked Mavis Staples to record an album for his label. It led to her latest album on Warner Brothers, produced by Prince, and co-produced by Al Bell, who produced many of the Staples Singers' records on Stax in the 70s. Many people were surprised at the pairing of Prince and Mavis Staples, since she's best known for gospel music, and he writes lyrics loaded with sexual allusions. This is only the fifth solo album she's ever recorded. Most of the songs were written by Prince. The title song, Time Waits for No One, was co-written by Prince and Mavis Staples.
You came to me, said give you more time. Time to get yourself together. Time to make up your mind. I want forever love. You want a one-night fantasy. While I'm sitting here waiting on you, you know, somebody somewhere is waiting on me. Time waits for no one. If you wait too long, you turn around and I'll be gone, gone.
Mavis Staples, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
The song we just heard, Time Waits for No One, was co-written by you and Prince. How did you co-write it?
Well, actually, I had written the song a few years ago. And Prince, as we were talking, he mentioned, well, Mavis, I want to know what's on your mind. I'd like to hear some of the songs that you've written. And I had a melody that was actually not quite up to par. And Prince reconstructed the melody. In fact, he did freshen it up with a couple of lyrics, too. So we actually did that long distance.
Mm-hmm. Prince's real sexy lyrics are about as far as you can get from sanctified music or message songs. Were you at all cautious about getting involved with working with him?
No, you know, I've been asked questions about Mavis. What are you doing working with this guy who writes these dirty lyrics? But for some reason, Terry, Prince's lyrics got past me. The dirty lyrics I didn't hear. You know? If you think about it, you really don't know what Prince is saying a lot of times unless you're reading it. And my main a love for Prince was his music, period. So now when his manager spoke to me and said that Prince wanted me on Paisley Park and he wanted to produce and write songs for me, I did ask him what type of songs would he write for me. But it wasn't because of his dirty lyrics. It was the things that I heard on Vanity and Apollonia, you know. And I told him, I said, well, you know, I'm a grown woman. And I needed some songs with substance. I felt like those were teeny bopper songs to me, you know. And he said, oh, Prince's, he would be writing adult songs for me with a contemporary background. And that was all I needed.
Well, I want to play an example of that. This is a song written by Prince for you, I presume. Interesting? It was written for you?
Yes.
And this record really gets the full Prince treatment.
Yes, indeed. before, and he brought out a lot of Mayweather's other personality, too.
Oh, like what?
Like Slick. You know, if you listen to Interesting, you know, I'm being real slick in there. And I'm actually flirting with this guy.
Uh-huh.
You know, because he walks in and I said, I mean, the song starts out with, like a bad politician. You know, you walked into the room and you're checking out. I mean, the lyrics tell it all, Terry.
Okay, let's give it a listen. This is an excerpt of Interesting from Mavis Staples' new album, Time Waits for No One, which was produced by Prince. And this is one of the songs he wrote.
Interesting. To the room. Interesting. You checking everybody out. I knew you'd get to me soon. Sooner or later. Interesting. Your cologne smelled like a garden in the middle of Rome. Ouch. Interesting. You offered me your body if I'd take you home.
Mavis Staples from her new album, Time Waits for No One. What was your family's reaction when you were young to singing secular songs?
That was a no-no. That was a no-no. In fact, Terry, I got the worst switching of my life for singing a blues song. And I was a kid in school. I was going to school down south at that time in Mount Bayou, Mississippi. And on a variety show, you'd hear Ella Johnson on the jukeboxes, you know, Since I Fell for You. And that song, just I liked it, and I would sing it to myself all the time. So doing a variety show, I knew I wanted to sing, and that song was the song that I was singing at the time. And I actually, my grandmother heard about it, and she gave me this nice little switching for it and let me know that, you know, no one had ever said to me, Mavis, don't sing the blues. Mavis, sing gospel songs only. So this was when I found out that, you know, my family was this, and I still didn't know because I was a kid, you know. But that was the first beginning of Mavis knowing that the Staples family would sing gospel.
Now, your father used to play blues before turning to gospel.
He did. Yes, but mostly just around the house or whatever, not actually on stage. Pops was inspired by guys like John Lemon, Blind John Lemon, and Harlan Wolf. You know, so when he first started playing his guitar, that was what he was playing. If you notice, you hear a lot of blues licks in the Staples Singers gospel songs, especially the first things that the first albums that we recorded. Because we had only Pops' guitar. That was the only music we had with us, and maybe a drum beat. But Pops still plays a very bluesy guitar.
It's an electric guitar, too. Is that unusual on the gospel circuit at the time?
Well, it was at that time. In fact, there were no guitars on stage, period.
Was that considered a more devilish instrument?
It certainly was. It certainly was. And Pops had to go to the Bible and let them know. You know, and in fact, I can't quote the exact scripture, Terry, but there is a scripture that it says, we shall rejoice with strings and tambourines. So you have a guitar instrument is a string. And shortly after, you know, when the church people seem to have gotten past it, shortly afterwards, every gospel a singer on the road brought in a guitar, an electric guitar. Pops's was still different, though. He had this tremolo on his, you know, and they would call his a nervous guitar. And so, but like I said, shortly after the Staple Singers came with Pops playing his guitar, every group, the Dixie Hummingbirds, the Nightingales, Mighty Clouds of Joy, any group, gospel group that you could name, hired a guitar player.
Well, why don't we hear something from the Staples family?
Okay.
And you're singing lead on this.
Okay.
This is I'm Leaning. Staples family with Mavis Staples singing lead. You know, listening to you sing, you can't help but think you could have been Aretha Franklin, if you know what I mean. You could have had a lot of that kind of success as a soul singer.
Yes.
Now, you have had lots and lots of success.
Yes.
But did you ever wish that you were singing secular songs and on top of the soul charts all the time, and with all of the fame and everything that comes to it, attached with that particular kind of secular success?
No, Terry, I really haven't. I was always happy singing with the family. My head just didn't ever go towards the being a solo artist and being at the top like that. I've had offers when I was a teenager, when I was singing with the family, things like Uncloudy Days. In our first years, I'd been offered millions to record secular music. People like VJ Records made offers, and other labels that were out during that time. But it just didn't appeal to me. And I've never felt that I've lost anything by not doing that. I've always felt that, you know, singing with the family and singing the gospel songs was the best for Mavis. But when I started doing these things in 69 with Stax, this too was to just try myself to see just how this would go, and also to enhance what the family was doing. But I've never even dwelled on getting out there like that. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your music, but first we're going to take a short break. Mavis Staples is my guest, and I'm sure you know her work through the Staples Singers, and now she has a new solo record called Time Waits for No One, and it's produced by Prince. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mavis Staples is my guest. Tell me how the family started singing together.
Well, we were kids. I guess I may have been about 6 years old. My mother worked nights, and my father worked days. During the day, my mother would keep us, and at night, Pops would keep us. So Daddy was singing with a quartet group at the time. And things weren't going with them. Things weren't going, you know, how you have six or seven guys together. During that time, it's hard for everybody to be, you know, on the same accord and thinking the same. So Pops just decided one night he quit. He couldn't go along with it anymore. And he came home, picked up his guitar, gave each one of us a part. You know, but we were just doing this really to amuse ourselves, Terry, while Pops was babysitting, I suppose. But it was never meant, we were never meant to venture out into making a career of singing.
Well, how did it become a career?
It became a career because we had an aunt, Aunt Katie, one of Daddy's sisters, lived with us. And she heard us rehearsing. She invited us to her church one Sunday. Well, we went out to sing at this church, and we knew one song. The people liked it so much, they clapped us back, and we had to sing that particular song over and over. So Pop said, well, we'll go home and learn some more songs. We recorded Uncloudy Day on a small label called United. And that record, a total gospel record, sold a million, which was unlikely at that time, in 1956. And letters just came from everywhere. Pops, my sisters, my brothers were working. I was still in school. And we were just flooded with these. So Pops said, they thought about it, giving up their jobs and getting out on the road to cover. All these people wanted to hear us and see us. So we just started, it took off from that particular song, Uncloudy Day.
You know what I find interesting about that? You're so associated with a family group,
mm-hmm.
and that you only were married a short time yourself. And
yes. Well, I think mine is because, you know, I was traveling. That had something to do with it. And we were young. My husband was young. At that time, you know, he wasn't quite ready for me leaving home all the time and whatnot, you know, but I wasn't about to stop singing. He never encouraged me to stop singing, but that was a lot for him, you know, for me to be leaving town a lot. And then I kind of married out of the totally, I think, maybe out of the entertainment, for an entertainer to marry, I married a mortician.
Oh, really?
So that was really a mismatch, yes. And the first parts of it, the first years of it was nice, but it got to be a bit much, I think, with me leaving town a lot.
Mavis Staples is my guest. Would you describe the church that you grew up in?
I grew up in a Baptist church. Very lively, where, as soon as the music started, I'd jump up and clap my hands. It was at Mount Eagle Baptist Church. Reverend C.J. Rogers was the pastor then. And I'm still in the same type of environment. I'm at Trinity United Church of Christ now, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And we, you know, it's not the sanctified church, but people rejoice in the same way. You know, we have a good time. It's always a good time church.
In the late 60s, I think it was, the Staple Singers started singing message songs, which
yes.
was a departure from the gospel music. How did you cross over into that?
Well, the message song, actually, we made two transitions. We made one transition first before that message. We went to protest songs. Our first thing was protest songs. That was during the time we were with Dr. King doing the movement. So we'd sing songs like March Up Freedom's Highway and Why Am I Treated So Bad? When will we be paid for the work we've done? All right, after we felt that things had gotten a little better, not all the way together, for as far as we were concerned, as far as the black movement went. But after the protest songs, we looked around and see gangs. So we came with Respect Yourself. These are the message songs, Respect Yourself. Songs like this.
I want to play something from that period.
Okay.
And this is I'll Take You There, which was a big hit.
Thank you.
The Staple Singers singing I'll Take You There. Mavis Staples singing lead. Mavis Staples is my guest. She has a new album, by the way, which is called Time Waits for No One, and it was produced by Prince. How often do the Staple Singers sing together now?
Oh, well, every now and then we get shows. We're not getting a whole lot of work. But I'd say we work together, I'd say, about 3 or 4 times a month. And they are mostly European tours.
So does this mean that it's hard to find dates in America for gospel music?
Well, a lot of times people have a tendency to think that if you're not recording, that you can't sing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people don't book you as much as they would if you had a hit record or if you were on the radio every day. See, so we haven't recorded for the last 10 years. And we get work in the States, but not a whole lot.
One last question. On the album jacket for your new album, Time mm-hmm. Waits for No One, the one produced by Prince?
Yes.
It's a fairly sexy cover, you know?
Yeah.
Yes. Are you comfortable with
and
that
I'm
image?
And I'm still sexy, too.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm just wondering if you're comfortable with presenting that kind of sexy
image. Oh, yes,
image.
Yes. Yeah. That's a part of me.
Okay.
You know, people have a tendency to think that you sing gospel songs and you're an evangelist, you know, or you wear a robe all the time and you walk around with a halo. But no, I'm a woman. I try to show myself as a woman as much as the next woman. You know, so like I say, you're going to see a lot more of Mavis's personality. There are a lot of little Mavis's off in here, and in this album, Prince is letting it be. No, he grabbed a whole lot of them. You know, a lot of those Mavis personalities that the world hasn't seen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music and your life. Thank you.
It was my pleasure, Terry.
My guest has been singer Mavis Staples. Her latest album is Time Waits for No One. She'll perform this weekend at the Blues 89 Festival at the Beacon Theater in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with songwriters Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine. They wrote the now classic songs Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas and the Trolley Song for the film Meet Me in St. Louis. They've written new songs for a Broadway production of Meet Me in St. Louis that opens this Thursday. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Marita Golden's Washington, D.C. isn't official Washington. Her novel isn't about politicians and power struggles. It's about the lives of the black middle class. Coming up, Golden talks with us about her new novel, Long Distance Life. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks at death in rock, from Tell Laura I Love Her to Leader of the Pack. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Cross of Fire, a new miniseries about the Ku Klux Klan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Reports from the Middle East that the first suicide boat attack against an Israeli target was made today. Security sources in Jerusalem are quoted as saying an Arab guerrilla blew up a fishing boat in the attack on an Israeli gunship off the coast of Lebanon. The guerrilla was killed, and three Israeli soldiers were wounded. An Israeli court today handed down a stiff prison sentence to a Palestinian convicted of killing 16 people last summer. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Jerusalem.
Last July, 24-year-old Abdel Hadig Naim was riding on an Israeli bus traveling from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem when he grabbed the steering wheel of the bus and forced it into a ravine. Today, Abdel Hadi was given 16 separate life terms in prison for each of the 16 people killed in the attack. He was also sentenced to 24 separate 20-year sentences for attempted murder of the remaining passengers on the bus. The Israeli police called it the bloodiest single incident during the Palestinian uprising. The Palestinians claimed the attack was the response of a frustrated young man to a stalled peace process and the hundreds of casualties among fellow residents of Nusayrat refugee camp in the Gaza Strip where he lives, a center of violent confrontations between soldiers and Palestinians. Abdel Hadi pleaded guilty to all counts. Under Israeli precedents, he might not be eligible for parole for perhaps 60 to 70 years. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
A bombing attack on the high command of the Salvadorian army missed its target today and killed one civilian. Tom Gibb reports from San Salvador.
A series of homemade mortars were set off from the back of two trucks parked in a shopping center near the high command. Some of the bombs landed close by the high command compound. Civilians said at least one wounded soldier was taken away. But several bombs also hit a gas station, killing one attendant and seriously wounding two others. Earlier in the year, leftist guerrillas launched a series of similar attacks with homemade catapult bombs against military bases in the capital. But they said they'd stopped the operations after a large number of civilian casualties. Now the attacks have started again. And in the countryside, fighting has stepped up in the last month as the army moves deep into rebel areas to forestall guerrilla operations. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
A protest in the middle of Moscow ended in violence today after riot police moved in and knocked scores of protesters to the ground. The official Soviet news agency TASS said about 40 people were detained in one of the toughest crackdowns on protesters in the Soviet city in more than a year and a half. The demonstrators were taking part in a vigil outside KGB headquarters in memory of Stalin's victims. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 6.5 points to close at 2,603.48 on volume of some 127 million shares. Trading was light. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. To get in the spirit of Halloween, rock and roll historian Ed Ward has decided to spook us with some gruesome hits and ghoulish trends of rock music past.
Forever, my darling, my love will be true, always and forever, I'll love just you.
On Christmas Eve 1955, a young black singer who was one of the fastest rising stars in the rhythm and blues world died backstage at a show in Houston, Texas. His name was Johnny Ace, and his death, officially called a suicide, but unofficially rumors still fly, began one of the most bizarre eras of rock and roll history. Almost before his heart stopped beating, his song, Pledging My Love, shot to the top of the charts, and a cult formed around his memory. 9 months later, actor James Dean died, and another death cult sprung up. For some time, teenagers had been slurping up comic books like Tales from the Crypt, in which slicing and dicing people was pretty commonplace. But in 1955, with all of this death around, the comics were banned, for fear of their effect on impressionable kids. So the kids turned to the only outlet they had left, rock and roll.
Tooling down the highway doing 79. I'm a twin pipe popper and I'm feeling fine. Hey man, dig that. Was that a red stop sign? Transfusion, transfusion. I'm just a solid mess of contusions. Never, never, never gonna speed again. Slip the blood to me, bud.
Nervous Norvus was a truck driver in his 40s when he recorded Transfusion in Nashville in 1956, but he found himself in the rarefied company of the best teenage idols when he found his record banned by every radio station in the country, making it the hottest under-the-counter hit in some time. Transfusion was funny, but in 1958, a different kind of record started to appear.
The night was black, rain falling down. Look for my baby. She's nowhere around. traced her footsteps down to the shore. Afraid she's gone forevermore. I looked at the sea and it seemed the same. I took your baby from you away. I heard a voice crying in the deep. Come join me, baby, in my endless sleep.
Jody Reynolds' girlfriend hasn't, as it turns out, committed herself to the endless sleep, and he saves her. But the song is manipulative, gruesome, and filled with the sort of overamped emotion teenagers love. It went straight into the top 10. The censors moved a little faster, though, when John Zacherle, who had a late-night horror movie show on Philadelphia TV, came up with Dinner with Drac, a humorous recitation in which the notorious Count served up questionable spaghetti and various other ghoulish delights. The record got played, but not until Zacherle had recorded a considerably toned-down version. No, child psychologists were much more worried about the records that actually told credible stories, like Thomas Wayne's 1959 hit, Tragedy, or this 1960 classic.
Teenager, teenager, teenager. That fateful night, the car was stalled upon the railroad track. I pulled you out and we were safe, but you went running back. Teen angel, can you hear me? Teen angel, can you see me? Are you somewhere up above? And am I still your own true love?
The vision of a girl ready to die for the singer's high school ring, which is why she went back to the car, may seem camp today, but such finely honed irony wasn't a part of the teen mindset back then, and Teen Angel's devotion was such a desirable virtue that the record shot to number one. It took a while for the professional songwriters in New York's Brill Building to discover the masochistic dream of finding the perfect love, only to have it die. The records we've just heard were all made in Nashville. But when they figured it out, they really got it right.
One day my dad said, find someone new.
Small and kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
Look out, look out, look out, look out!
Leader of the Pack was another one that was too strong to stop. As further proof that teenagers understood what was happening, even though nobody else did, while various organizations tried to get the record banned, kids flocked to another record, Leader of the Laundromat by the Detergents. They could pine for death or laugh at it, either way. And, in fact, this gruesome genre of rock and roll went out with one of the most tastelessly funny records of all. Jimmy Cross describes driving back from a Beatles concert with his baby, only to have a head-on collision in the rain with the Leader of the Pack.
It's been many months now since that fateful night, and you know something I've tried. Believe me, I have tried, but I just can't make it without my baby. So I've decided I'm gonna have her back one way or another. Oh, baby, I dig you so much. Hot dang pay dirt.
I'll leave you to guess what happens next. Happy Halloween.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle.
This is Fresh Air. When Marita Golden was in college, she fell in love with a Nigerian architectural student. He was the son of a chief. They married and she moved with him to Nigeria. But once there, she found she couldn't conform to family expectations of the traditional Nigerian wife. She moved with her baby son back to America. She's since written a memoir and two novels. Her new novel, Long Distance Life, is set in Washington, D.C., where Golden grew up and now lives. Long Distance Life is the story of three generations of a black family. It begins in the South in the 20s and follows the family as they migrate north. The story is set against the social movements of the times. Golden says that Washington played an important role in the social history of African Americans.
Well, it's important because, one, it was carved out of the state of Maryland, which was the largest slaveholding state in the Union. And you had right there in the a couple of blocks from the Capitol, slave pens where African Americans were sold. It's important also because it was the first stop on the trains above the Mason-Dixon line that brought African Americans from the South during the Great Migration of the late 20s and 30s. It's important also because of institutions like Howard University, which formed the bedrock of the black middle class, certainly. And it's lastly important because it's been a venue for protests around issues of equality and racism affecting blacks for as far back as our history goes. And in fact, in the book, there's a scene where one of the characters is involved in a protest dealing with the Scottsboro Boys in 1933, and that actually did occur. And I just thought it would be kind of neat to have one of my characters involved in a protest that really is historically accurate.
Now, this is why you spent 8 months in the Library of Congress.
Yeah, that was around near the end when I had my story. I had my characters, and I knew what was going to happen to them. And then I had to rediscover the city of my birth. And to do that, I did do a lot of research at the Library of Congress, but I also talked to people in my own family who had come up from the South. I was lucky enough to find a woman who was doing research on black women migrants from the South who became domestic workers, which is essentially my mother's story, but my mother is dead. So she let me listen to these tapes, and the tapes were incredible as a source of really rich inspiration. And Washington's a wonderful city because it draws like a magnet so many talented and adventurous people to it, so that when I wanted to find out about the civil rights movement, there were just all these women there who had been involved in the movement, and I could talk to them. So I really didn't have to leave. Everything was there for me.
Well, you've said that the character of Naomi, the matriarch in this family, is based on your mother. I'm going to ask you to read a short excerpt from the beginning. This is in Naomi's voice.
There's no secret to living so long like I have. Nothing you can bottle and sell. I just tried to do right by folks, and that took me a long way. There was an old woman down south where I come from. She was the woman everybody went to with their troubles. They called her Granny Eyes, because she could see so good what would happen to you if you did this or if you didn't do that. She worked roots and healed folks through faith. Today she'd be making a load of money, but back then folks just brought her whatever they had. And people always asked Granny Eyes, when she looked them in the face real hard, to explain what was ailing them, or when she'd start to decipher them cards she used or fixing up some potion. Folks would start asking, what it looked like, Granny Eyes, what it looked like. And she'd just say, it looked like life to me.
Did your mother ever say that, by the way?
No, but my mother did believe in spiritualists and faith healers. And that was a direct result of her upbringing in the South. She did believe in that. And there were women in our neighborhood who I remember when I would be going through horrible love affairs or something, and she would say, well, you know, you can just go down and see Miss Mamie on the corner and she'll just tell her what's wrong. And I would say, oh, Mom, stop it. You know, I'm in college. I'm too rational for that.
Did you feel that you lost something by being that rational?
Not then, but I think probably now, certainly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Naomi, the matriarch of the family.
I prefer to call her the center or the good kind of spiritual consciousness.
And tell me why you don't like the word matriarch.
Because it's sort of, I think that it's inaccurate in that Black society is not matriarchal. And it's a term that has a lot of pejorative connotations, even though I suspect that your connotations are not pejorative. But
The connotations being there's no men around, so the woman has to run the family?
And it connotes, in a real matriarchal situation, as in African societies, there is a certain amount of power and influence that the women do have.
Mm-hmm.
But as it's applied to African-American women, it's just the reverse. But I saw her as kind of the griot of the family. That's why she's all of her sections are in the first person, because she's the emotional center, the spiritual lock, and she's the conscience of that family over this period of time that the book covers.
Mm-hmm. Naomi's daughter, Esther, leaves her son for 5 years and goes south, joins the civil rights movement. Are you saying there that you think motivation sometimes for political activism are very complex?
Yes. You're the second person to ask me. Yeah, I think that a lot of times some of the most effective political leaders have been and often are people who are neurotic, people who are seeking to lose and find themselves, to make up for some absence, some something that they lost, something they never had, through involvement in something very large, something bigger than themselves. So I think that that is often a motivation much more frequently than we acknowledge, more often than philosophical motivation, altruistic motivation. And I don't see that that is necessarily wrong. If you can't deal with the family, well, okay, maybe you can deal with 1,000 people and make their lives better. But yeah, I think that's a real strong motivation for people.
And part of Esther's motivation for leaving is that she feels very claustrophobic in her home life, and she needs to leave.
And she needs to find herself. And in all of my books, there's always some female character who does that, who goes off and finds a definition of self through a much larger societal or political experience. I think it probably mirrors my own journey to Africa when I was in my early 20s. And that was the most, profound experience of my adult life.
Another theme in your new novel is people walking out on people and then returning again. And I was wondering if that's happened in your life, if anyone has ever walked out on you and showed up years later.
No. No, it hasn't. But I think I was more intrigued by the idea that you can return, that when you leave, you can return, that family is the place where they have to take you in. And that's what Esther does find, that as Naomi says to her, you were my daughter all the years that you were away. You were still Logan's mother all those years that you were away. So that I do believe that it is possible. I believe in second chances profoundly. And I do believe that you can come home again.
Well, you came home again in a way, because you left the United States when mm-hmm. you were, I guess, in your early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
You married a Nigerian man mm-hmm. and went with him to live in Nigeria. And you write about this in your autobiography, Memoirs. Mm-hmm.
Migrations
of the Heart. Mm-hmm. But you found that the life really wasn't your life, that you weren't ready to fit yourself into the life of a traditional Nigerian woman,
mm-hmm.
and you came back to the United States. So you decided that You wanted to come home again.
Yeah, I guess it's. I guess that there is a level also, certainly that in my own life, I have come home again. I thought with unblinking certitude that my destiny was in Africa, but it wasn't, because there were stories that I was supposed to write that were not there, but that were in, of all places, my hometown of Washington, which seemed to me at that time the most unglamorous, unexciting place on earth. But my destiny was not where I thought it was. It was back right where I started. So I think, yeah, and I have found the experience of being back in Washington very satisfying. After leaving it, I left after I graduated from American University. And the city has matured politically and artistically in the years I was away. So it's a very different kind of city. And for a writer, it's a city that is more congenial and more has more to inspire you.
Marita Golden's new novel, Long Distance Life, is published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. On our program tonight, NPR's Ann Cooper reports from the Soviet Union about a candlelight vigil in Moscow. About 1,000 demonstrators gathered, a human rights demonstration outside the KGB headquarters there, the secret police headquarters in Moscow. They were dispersed, in some cases with some violence by police officers said to be using clubs. And a report from New York State, the Mohawk Indian Reservation there. Authorities have been unable to stop illegal casino action and high-stakes bingo on the reservation. Also, a report and some music from David Byrne's new solo album, which is Brazilian-influenced.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. More and more these days, today's headlines are the inspiration for tomorrow's docudramas. This weekend, however, NBC begins a 4-hour miniseries that's based on true events from the 1920s. And TV critic David Bianculli recommends it.
Cross of Fire is a love story. It's also a hate story. It's the story of a man who rises to power as a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, and of the woman he loves to the point of obsession, even when she rejects his advances. It's got elements of Citizen Kane and Fatal Attraction and the Costa Gavras movie Betrayed, and it's got some of the best performances you'll see on TV this year. The cast is led by an all-star group of young actors best known for their yuppie whining. John Hurd plays the Klan leader. You might remember him as the toy company junior executive shot down by Tom Hanks in the movie Big. Mel Harris, who plays Hope on 30-something, co-stars as the woman he loves. And David Morse, who played Dr. Boomer Morrison on St. Elsewhere, plays the meek small-town attorney who loves her too. All of these actors are terrific. As D.C. Stevenson, Hurd demonstrates his charisma in the very first scene by visiting a country store and charming the storekeeper and his customers, including a bitter World War I veteran.
Years and years of war, and what we come home to, immigrants. Now, immigrants drive us out of our jobs, overwhelming our schools. And our elected officials using public office for private profit.
Maybe your elected officials. Sure as hell ain't mine.
Well, that's my point. That's my point exactly. I mean, doesn't it seem to you folks that, I don't know, there's something wrong with America? And the values that we fought and died for are disappearing. They're disappearing right before our very eyes.
Before long, Stevenson is so powerful that he literally dictates his own terms to a man seeking his support in a local election.
Write this down and sign it. In return for the political support of D.C. Stevenson, and in the event that I'm elected mayor of Indianapolis, Indiana, I promise not to appoint any person member of the Board of Public Works without their first having the endorsement of D.C. Stevenson. I also promise and agree...
That's insane. What if the letter were discovered?
This will be the only copy of the letter that exists, and I'll have it. We can go a lot further than mayor. We can do a lot more good than you can on your own, John.
St- Stevenson is just as aggressive while pursuing a beautiful young woman who's played by Mel Harris. For a while, she's attracted by his stature and his style and believes his stories that people posing as Klansmen, not Klansmen themselves, are inciting all the racial hatred. But one day she learns the truth and confronts him with it.
I met a family, a black family, whose barn was burned last night. The men who burned their barn wore hoods. They set fire to a cross in their front yard. A cross of fire. Sound familiar?
Oh, my God. Knight Riders.
No, the men who did this were not Knight Riders. Whatever that is, they were Klansmen.
Madge, honestly, if these men were Klansmen and I knew their names, I would prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law.
What happens next is too startling and dramatically powerful to ruin by mentioning here. But eventually, Stevenson is put on trial, and the meek small-town attorney is assigned to prosecute him. This is where Lloyd Bridges, as the defense attorney, and George Zunza, as the town's newspaper editor, make their own wonderful contributions to the miniseries. Cross of Fire, as a story of power and passion, has an almost Shakespearean dimension to it, and director Paul Wendkost gets performances from his actors that are worthy of a classic tragedy. Not many miniseries these days are worth the time it takes to make them or watch them, but Cross of Fire is a fascinating exception.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Audrey Vablaitis, Bob Alls, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, songwriters Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine tell us about writing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas and The Trolley Song. They've written several new songs for a new Broadway production of Meet Me in St. Louis. Also, John Updike tells us about the pleasures of looking at art. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.